From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
So, Florida lawmakers decided to go home for at least a week. We'll delve into what happened.
Even when they're controlled by one party, it doesn't mean you get along on every single issue.
Also this week, more open government exemptions came out of this year's lawmaking session.
We should have some sanctuary in our own homes, much less when we're out and about.
We'll also learn how the state's food banks may have caught a funding break from the legislature and discover how some lawmakers now favor a measure that could mean more medical malpractice litigation. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee.
Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org. The Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com.
Florida's legislative session is technically ending today, but lawmakers will be back in Tallahassee soon. The two legislative chambers have not yet come to an agreement on the budget. Tristan Wood reports some political watchers say the situation is a stark departure from recent history.
One of the main points of disagreement causing this hang-up is about how to reduce taxes in the state. Governor Ron DeSantis wants to abolish property taxes. House Speaker Daniel Perez wants to look into that, but also reduce the sales tax by 3/4 of a cent. Senate President Ben Albritton wants to make clothes and shoes under $75 tax-exempt, but is hesitant to pass a permanent sales tax reduction. Under state law, the legislature must come up with a budget by July 1st when the new fiscal year starts. Perez told his chamber they will be heading home for next week, and he is still in talks with the Senate about when they will come back.
I know that many of you are anxious for news. However, I don't want to make any formal updates until we have all the necessary pieces worked out, and we are currently working on them. What I can say is this, I remain hopeful. I know you won't have to be here next week, and it would be my expectation to work out a schedule with the Senate in short time so that all of you will know the specific dates on when you have to be back in Tallahassee. That will allow you to then make your necessary plans.
This uncertainty is in stark contrast to how the legislature operated in recent years, says University of Central Florida political science professor Aubrey Jewett. He says the legislature previously worked in lockstep with what Governor Ron DeSantis wanted. Now, the new legislative leadership not only have disagreements with DeSantis, but loud public disagreements with each other. Jewett says the disagreement about taxes likely stemmed from current economic uncertainty.
One, because of the uncertainty of the national economy and the tariffs that President Trump has put in place, there is a real possibility that there's going to be an economic slowdown. We also have a situation where the federal government has been sending a lot of money to the states over the last 5 or 6 years, but that source of money is drying up. And so there's going to be billions less in the from the federal government coming in. And so basically, for the Senate president in particular is very reluctant to make big permanent tax cuts that may hamstring future legislatures and create real fiscal difficulties for the state.
Ultimately, Jewett views the disagreements as a good thing for Floridians and a sign that the state's government is functioning as intended. as checks and balances on each other to ensure policy that considers a wide range of Floridians gets passed.
Even when they're controlled by one party, it doesn't mean you get along on every single issue, because we're a big state with over 20 million people, and there's a lot of diverse perspectives, even within the dominant Republican conservative majority. So I think that's healthy, personally. I think it's healthier than what we had seen in the previous 6 years, when the governor just got everything that the governor wanted, and the legislature didn't seem to be standing up at all and acting independently at all. So to that degree, I think it's a good thing.
Expect an announcement where legislative leaders will announce the plans for the special session to resolve the budget to come sometime soon. I'm Tristan Wood.
This was a very good legislative session for secrecy in Tallahassee. But don't tell anybody. But Steve Bosquet will tell us how lawmakers overwhelmingly voted to make themselves less accessible to the public.
When Representative Susan Valdez switched parties from Democrat to Republican a few months ago, not everyone in her Tampa district thought it was such a great idea.
All of a sudden, we were starting to get threats, death threats. I had to send my staff home. No elected official, none, should fear for their life.
That shocking experience prompted Valdez to sponsor a bill to create a public records exemption unprecedented in Florida history. The home addresses and phone numbers of most elected officials will be secret for those officials who choose to take advantage of it. It applies to legislators, mayors, city and county commissioners, school board members, and members of Congress. Nearly everyone voted for it.
The clerk will unlock the machine and members will proceed to vote. Have all members voted? Have all members voted? The clerk will lock the machine and announce the vote.
113 yeas, 2 nays, Mr. Speaker.
So the bill passes. Read the next bill.
That was the House vote on Senate Bill 268 after it cruised through the Senate with only 2 no votes in each chamber. Support for keeping personal information secret had wide support in both parties from Democrats such as Representative Allison Tant of Tallahassee.
And, I mean, this is serious. This actually happens. And so I'm really glad you brought this bill, because we should have some sanctuary at our own homes, much less when we're out and about.
If Governor Ron DeSantis signs the bill, it could widen the gap between elected officials and the public. People who want to peacefully protest outside the mayor's home may not be able to find the right address. Voters and reporters may have trouble verifying if a legislator lives in his district. Republican Senator Don Gates of Niceville was one of the few who opposed the bill. He grew up in North Dakota, where his father was in politics, and political talk often took place in the family driveway.
Our family has had death threats, and recently, and not just as a result of my son being in Congress. I recently had a death threat, but I also understand that most people, nearly all people, who make death threats are liars and cowards.
Gates said a loss of personal privacy is part of the sacrifice of holding office. He was recorded as voting yes on the bill, even though he opposed it, and said his vote was in error. Only Democratic Senators Lori Berman of Boca Raton and Carlos Guillermo Smith of Orlando voted no. I'm Steve Bosquet.
Coming up on Capitol Report, we'll hear from the former Florida Democratic Party rising star who suddenly left the party to blaze his own trail.
I know there's a large clutch of angry or shocked people at my decision. Most of them, though, and the loudest voices are ones that are just pissed they can't hit me up for money.
When it comes to Florida's medical malpractice laws, some are arguing that old laws aren't necessarily good laws.
This is a 35-year-old law. It needs to be repealed. It's unjust. It shouldn't be on the books.
Despite big cuts in federal help, Florida's regional food banks could be making that up and then some with extra help from state government.
Right now, what they're considering is a $50 million budget line for the support of this program.
And once again, Florida finds itself on the cutting edge of culture. More and more backyards are foregoing lawns and ornamental flowers for tropical fruit trees.
They are so much better if you can hand pick them in your own tree.
State Senator Jason Pizzo, the Democratic leader in Florida's Senate, made waves by announcing he's leaving the party to register as an independent late last month. In a speech on the Senate floor, Pizzo declared the party dead and compared today's bipartisanship to the fall of Rome. WLRN's Carlton Gillespie spoke with him about the party's future and his next move.
Your announcement that you are no longer going to be a part of the Democratic Party, you've now changed your affiliation to independent. You know, in your statement, you said the Florida Democratic Party is dead. Why is that?
If you look at from a fundraising and financing perspective, the resources available, we took a precipitous drop after Obama and then leading into subsequent cycles. So I think in 2018, I think like the DNC raised or put in $49, $50 million and then it whittled down to one. The last two cycles, I've actually been, the largest private donor to state House, state Senate, and local races. And I think I participated in artificially kind of resuscitating, you know, what was really a terminal case.
Two other Democrats have switched their party affiliation to Republican this year. You went as an independent. Why that change?
Numbers speak for themselves. There's nearly 3,690,000 registered NPAs. People are kidding themselves. Politicians are kidding themselves if they don't believe that there is a huge gaping hole in the center and on the fringes of the left and the right that are just sort of thirsting for just rational and reasonable people. The bulk of what we spent time with, anyone would have to argue and agree objectively over the last decade, has been socially divisive, very loud distractions from actually resolving and addressing real needs of Floridians. And I think people are just sort of just done with the loud noise from left and right. And we'd just like people to perhaps take the opportunity, the limited time that we have on a yearly basis here in Tallahassee, when we're all a captive audience, to perhaps address property insurance and affordability and the environment, resiliency and transportation.
And you think Democrats don't have the ability, at least as they're currently constructed, to reach those people in the center?
The one sort of plea I made as incoming leader when I was elected by my colleagues, my caucus members, was don't take the bait. You know, certain things only get life because we have breathed sort of oxygen into them. And it does two things. It's a huge opportunity cost loss by being distracted into following and going down rabbit holes of nonsense from the DeSantis on woke and CRT and all of these things that Floridians don't really care about. They care about, how am I going to make my mortgage payment? Is my kid going to go to a school that's safe on campus? Are they going to get a decent education? Is there going to be a job opportunity for them? And so my plea was don't take the bait. And we do it all the time.
This has happened, you know, relatively quickly for you. You were tapped as the party's Democratic leader after the 2024 elections, correct?
I think people knew that I was going to be a leader for a while. But, you know, again, there's just things that people just, they don't want to hear about it anymore. They don't want to deal with it anymore. And they don't have a voice for those people. And I have some sympathy for my colleagues who have to do what the party tells them, that have to do what a lobbyist tells them because they gave them 50 grand or 100 grand of their campaign. And I don't suffer that. But at the same time, I know there's a large clutch of angry or shocked people at my decision. Most of them, though, and the loudest voices are ones that are just pissed they can't hit me up for money this year and next year. I fundraised over $5 million for the Senate Democratic Caucus in a declining, condition and status of the Democratic Party as a whole. I was very honest in my assertion that I didn't think we were going to pick up any seats, which I think is a win based on declining, you know, Democratic registrations compared to the Delta and Republicans. I was lambasted for that, but it proved to be true. And on the House side, they lost members. So I brought back every single Senate Democratic member in the 24 election. No other entity can say that, certainly not the House.
Will you now run for governor as an independent?
I'm going to go run for the golf course and go play a couple holes is what I'm going to do.
That was WLRN's Carlton Gillespie speaking with former Florida Senate Democratic leader Jason Pizzo. The Florida legislature has approved a controversial bill that would allow some family members to pursue medical malpractice lawsuits over the deaths of their parents and adult children. Margie Menzel has more.
The bill repeals the 1990 law that limits who can pursue malpractice cases after a family member's death. Jacksonville Republican Senator Clay Yarborough is behind the effort. He says the issue came to his attention from hearing the stories of family members.
This is a 35-year-old law. It needs to be repealed. It's unjust. It shouldn't be on the books.
Currently, due to the 1990 law, parents can't pursue non-economic damages and malpractice cases involving the deaths of their children if those children are 25 or older. And children 25 or over can't pursue non-economic damages in malpractice cases involving their parents. Non-economic damages mean intangible losses from a trauma or injury, such as pain and suffering.
And I heard all the stories. I wanted to vote for this.
That's Stewart Republican Senator Gail Harrell. She supported an attempt to amend Yarborough's bill to add a $1 million cap on non-economic damages in all medical malpractice lawsuits involving patient deaths.
I wanted for individuals to be able to get economic damages and have a limit on what the non-economic damages would be so that we could also make sure we have physicians and hospitals in the state of Florida. But unfortunately, we no longer have that cap on the bill.
Without a cap on damages, Harrell worries the move would drive up medical malpractice premiums and exacerbate the lack of access to medical providers in Florida.
We already have a tremendous shortfall in primary care, and that includes family medicine, internal medicine, OBGYN, pediatrics, ER. And by 2035, we're going to have the need for over 7,872 additional practitioners. Then you look at specialty care. This is even more devastating.
The state is looking at a deficit of more than 10,000 physicians in the near future, Harrell said. But most senators praise the measure. Here's Orlando Democratic Senator Carlos Guillermo Smith.
Senators, we have a good bill in front of us. We have a clean bill, no caps, because you can't put a price on a life. The victims and the families of wrongful death due to medical malpractice deserve this bill. And thank you for bringing it to the Senate floor.
The Senate voted 33-4 to approve the measure. Given that the House passed the bill in March, it's now heading to the desk of Governor Ron DeSantis. I'm Margie Menzel.
Combine the recent COVID pandemic and the steady rise of inflation, and the percentage of Floridians suffering food insecurity has been increasing. The State Department of Health has shown the overall rate going from just under 11% of the population in 2021 to more than 13% the following year. And that works out to nearly 3 million Floridians. Much of that need has been served by Florida's 9 regional food banks. One of them is Second Harvest of the Big Bend, which serves 16 North Florida counties. Like so many organizations, it receives some of its resources from the federal government. And in the past week, Second Harvest CEO Monique Ellsworth got some bad news from the feds as the Trump administration has been slashing funding, especially when it came to a number of her key programs.
LFPA, for the last few years, it has allowed us to purchase produce from local growers and farmers. We receive just over $2 million in funding through that program. So that funding will go away. The second impact that we have seen was AmeriCorps, the funding not continuing there. And for us, that was two members of our team. Third impact is a program called CSFP. Essentially, that is our senior grocery program.
Essentially, a Meals on Wheels, which delivers groceries instead of prepared meals. Yet, despite all this bad news, Ellsworth seems surprisingly upbeat. She says that's because the food banks don't get all their support from the federal government. A big chunk of it comes from the state of Florida.
We are allocated a portion of the funds for the program Farmers Feeding Florida every year. It's funds for us to spend with local state farmers and growers. Great way for us to be supporters of the local economic engine, paying into local small farms, larger farms, making sure that food is sourced here locally and stays local, which we want that.
And it seems lawmakers feel the same way. Florida Senate President Ben Albritton's big push this session was what he called the Rural Renaissance Initiative. Part of that was providing more markets for the state's food growers. North Florida Republican Senator Corey Simon took the point on an agriculture bill that would do just that. Luckily, says Ellsworth, it included significant funding for the 9 regional food banks.
Right now, what they're considering is a $50 million budget line for support of this program. And that is a significant increase to the funds that have historically been allocated to us. So should that pass, that would more than make up for the loss that we have seen at a federal level. The state of Florida will really have stepped in to ensure that Floridians are being fed, that food is being sourced from our state, and that the state dollars are staying within the state paying local businesses.
Of course, nothing is certain until lawmakers reconvene and actually vote out a unified budget to send to the governor. Still, Ellsworth is hopeful. Her hope is also reinforced by a number of large private sector donations, one from Capital Health Plan, the big HMO used by so many Tallahassee state government workers.
Like our healthcare partnerships, evolving CHP, being a leader in that space. We're just so grateful that them and many others are seeing the work that we do and understanding that the health of our community in many ways is directly related to what folks are eating.
So at least for now, the status of Florida's large regional food banks seems to be a lot better than it could be, given the uncertainty of the times. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, what do you say we leave all the political intrigue and spend some time in a peaceful garden full of tasty tropical delights? WLRN's Jenny Jacoby brings us the growing South Florida trend of folks turning their backyards into tropical fruit gardens.
From the front of his house, Victor Cheney's home looks like any other. It's only when you step into his backyard that you begin to realize how special the small plot of land is. Tucked into a neighborhood in Cooper City, Florida, Cheney is maintaining a collection of more than 50 different fruiting trees and shrubs, many of which are some of the rarest fruits in the country. He's a full-time pathologist who had no experience growing plants. His collection began with one tree, which is a Brazilian berry fruit, most similar to a grape, but sweeter. With nothing other than his instinct and the help of Google to guide him, Cheney got his start in the tropical fruit tree world.
The first tree that I saw, it was a jabaticaba tree. I thought it was unusual. It had all these purple fruits that were over the trunks and trees. I tried it, and it was very good. So that was the first tree that I got when my nursery was moving. And since then, it got me just, I guess it started my interest in unusual tropical fruit trees.
This interest soon expanded to include the lucrative mangosteen, a highly sought-out fruit that's gained popularity in recent years.
It's called the queen of fruits. It's supposedly one of the best-tasting fruits of the world. It's common in Southeast Asia, but it's very difficult to get here. There's some Asian groceries that you can get them, but they're usually frozen, and they're not as tasty, you know, as fresh.
The fruits are sold at a high price point, with online sites charging upwards of $100 for only a few mangosteen. That's in part because of how difficult they are to grow. It's considered an ultra-tropical plant, meaning it gets damaged if the temperature falls below 40 degrees Fahrenheit. But in 2023, Cheney's purple mangosteen plant produced 5 fruits. He's one of the only people in the continental U.S. reported to have done so.
I looked it up, and there's very few reported cases of fruiting the mangosteen outside of continental United States. Of course, it can fruit in Hawaii and Puerto Rico, where it's a more tropical climate. But I put it in a pot, you know, I had different soils that I used to get something that it would grow best in, and I hit upon the right combination, I guess. And when it got cooler, I would take it inside, into the garage.
South Florida's tropical climate is a gold mine for fruit gardeners, and rising temperatures from climate change have only added to that.
Well, climate change is working in my favor in regards to ultra-tropical trees. Most of the ones I have will survive freezing, but when they're smaller, they may not. So it's definitely helped.
Karim Rossi is a fellow Broward County backyard gardener boasting his own collection of more than 75 fruit, spice, or nut trees, and more than 100 other plants. He too has noticed that fewer cold snaps and more warm days have expanded the possibilities of what he's able to grow in South Florida.
So, for example, breadfruit was believed to only be able to grow in the Keys because it's considered to be almost an extra tropical, but it grows very well right here in Broward County.
He's also the vice president and longtime member of the Rare Fruit and Vegetable Council of Broward County, a group of gardeners, researchers, and rare plant lovers that maintain a 2.5-acre garden filled with nearly 300 different types of plants. The council brings together people from all different parts of the world who share how to grow plants native to their own countries.
Every culture brings knowledge, too, about fruits from their own country. So we learn about recipes from those countries, or we learn about how they call that tree in their own language. So it's a very educational organization.
Rossi grows just about anything he can get his hands on, including 18 different varieties of mango trees in his backyard. Many of these seeds and trees he sources from the council itself, which hosts plant sales twice a year. Both Rossi and Cheney have found love for this hobby, in part because it gives them access to fruits they wouldn't be able to find in the grocery store.
But there's certain things you can get at the grocery store easily. But there's some other things that they are so much better if you can hand-pick them in your own tree. Like, I love picking the mangoes, and they're fresh, and they are fiberless, and they're so tasty.
For Cheney, his favorite fruit from his garden is the mangosteen. But there are all different types of rare fruits, from Key West Mamey to Aki to Firebush, that may not be easy to find unless they come from someone's backyard. With warming temperatures and a continued love and interest in gardening, there's no telling what may be the next rare fruit to grow in South Florida. I'm Jenny Jacoby in Miami.
As we've already noted, Florida lawmakers are taking a break, at least through next week, but we'll be back next Friday with our next Capitol Report online and for many Florida public radio stations, also on air. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Carlton Gillespie and Jenny Jacoby. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org. The Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.